Welcome, everybody, to another beautiful spring day here in February at the Capitol. We're going to just tell you the schedule for today. We're actually going to start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. We're going to continue that public hearing to approximately 2 o'clock. So keep that in mind with your testimony and others who would like to testify. We've got two members that are coming from afar. One at 1:30 can be here and the other one at 2 o'clock. And the person just entering the door was Senator Walker. and then we'll do our work sessions at that point when we have our complement of the committee. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 323 and ask Senator Walker, who has just entered the room, to come forward.
Holy cow. Oh, thank you, Mr.
Chair. Not exercising that pedometer? Is that what you've been doing?
You know, I think that it should register more steps when you run. It's really not fair. Okay, well, I am delighted to be here on this bill. And I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. That is my district, yes. Okay. It's interesting, the life in the legislature this session. As you know, every session, we have an issue about independent contractors. Every single session since I've been here in 1999, we have a bill. It'll pass the chamber. It won't pass the other. Or the governor vetoes it. We all seem to disagree about what independent contractors mean and how to write it in the statute. So last session, we actually passed a bill, and it went to conference committee, and we worked out a deal. And the deal was that we would implement the law, and it would have a delayed implementation date, and in the meantime, we'd develop a task force, and we would get together and work. Now, task forces, a lot of times, they just produce a nice report that goes on the shelf. This task force worked its hiney off. We met at least 10 times that I know of. I think I only missed one meeting due to a conflict. And we met for about 3 hours every time. We had great participation by all the parties. We developed an incredible piece of legislation that you're going to hear about today. And I'm going to let all the other people talk to you about that. But I think we have a product here that is going to finally lay to rest the issue about independent contractor status and how it will be interpreted by the law, who's an independent contractor, who's not. So I'm going to let all those folks talk to you about it. But I want to thank everyone who is so involved in this process. And I think there's probably there are a couple of amendments that we'll be talking about today. Actually, I have the dash 2. I'm not sure I got the dash 1 back. But the dash 2, do you have that one?
Dash 1 won't be ready until 2.
And the dash 1 will be ready when?
Until 2.
2 o'clock.
Oh, 2 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay, that's a simple one line. Simple one lines can be explosive, but that simple one line can be fine. And I think there might be a little bit of discussion, but for the most part, you have a bill here that with just a little bit more of a finer tweak is going to be a really good piece of legislation. And it's going to be helpful to employers, it's going to be helpful to employees, and it's going to be helpful to people such as myself who are independent contractors so that we don't get caught in the web. We don't get employers caught in the web. And that's the big issue, because nobody likes paying fines for doing something wrong that they thought they were doing right. And that was the big issue that we've consistently had, is that everyone seemed to have a different interpretation of the law, Mr. Chair. So I think you're going to enjoy the testimony. I'd like to stick around, but I have another committee, so I will get the full report later and appreciate your time. And if you have any questions, you know where to find me.
All right, we know where to find you. Thank you, Senator.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's begin that presentation. I'm going to ask Lisa Trussell, who was the chair of the Independent Contractor Task Force, and Elizabeth Harchenko to come forward and give us the overview of your work. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell, and I work for AOI, but my role today here is as the chair of the Independent Contractor Task Force. And I also want to apologize in advance, but I have a throat lozenger that if I don't keep that in my mouth, I'm going to be coughing through the whole presentation. So I hope you'll indulge me. I want to thank Senator Vicky Walker for her participation and leadership on the task force, and I also want to acknowledge the participation and leadership of Representative Alan Brown. They played key roles in the development of the bill you have before you. What I would like to do is provide you some background information and some general information about the work of the task force, and then Elizabeth will walk you through the bill and highlight the key elements. Prior to the 2003 session, the definition for independent contractor was found in the ORS's 670.600. And that definition was created in 1989 and was to apply for Department of Revenue for income tax purposes, the Employment Department for unemployment insurance purposes, and the Workers' Comp Division for workers' comp purposes. As you can imagine, the types of businesses and the way of doing business have changed significantly since 1989. And while the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue still use ORS 670.600, court case law has caused for some separation of the workers' comp division from the statutory definition. During the 2003 legislative session, there was an effort to change the definition for all of these agencies. However, what finally was passed was Senate Bill 232, which established a new definition for independent contractor only for the Oregon Department of Revenue. This definition for the Department of Revenue would become effective January 1, 2006. Senate Bill 232 also established the Independent Contractor Task Force to study the issues related to the definition of an independent contractor. The appointments of task force members were made in November 2003. The final report lists the 17 members, which reflect representation from the legislature, employers, labor, and state agencies. A total of 10 task force meetings were held to gather information, discuss the issues and ideas, make findings, and to formulate its final recommendations in the form of a legislative concept, which you have before you today in the form of Senate Bill 323. Before Elizabeth walks you through the bill, though, let me summarize the findings and recommendations of the task force. First, the key findings. There is some confusion among employers, workers, and professional advisors created by sharing differing standards and interpretations of the existing law, and that was quite clear during the hearings last session as well. There is unfair competition created by business firms that misclassify workers as independent contractors, gives them a competitive price advantage that the others who are classifying their workers correctly don't share. There should be enhanced, more consistent, coordinated enforcement and compliance activities. That was clear. That caused much confusion and consternation amongst a wide variety of people when different agencies had different opinions as to the status of an individual. There should be greater understanding and ease of compliance for employers and workers. There's a desire that any new definition not result in the erosion of the social safety net for workers, and that's unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. And that the statutory definition of an independent contractor should be consistent for the impacted agencies, and that's Department of Employment, Department of Revenue, the Workers' Comp Division, part of DCBS. Now the recommendations. A legislative concept for a definition of an independent contractor that is consistent for the impacted state agencies, thereby that also allowing for greater coordinated standards, interpretation, application, and enforcement, and that is a key element. Addresses the concerns about the possible erosion of the social safety net protections for workers, and it addresses the concerns and interests expressed by employer, worker, and agency representatives. A recommended set of enhanced and coordinated agency administrative services, such as web-based application for information, including a homepage with general information for employers, workers, and the public on reporting, compliance topics, and links to the agencies and other independent contractor resources. We think that will be significant enhancement. development of industry-specific guidelines to assist employers, workers, and the public to better understand the interpretation and application of the definition. You can see there's a lot of educational pieces as a part of this. And offering of voluntary consultation services such as technical assistance, education, and consultation sessions with state agency reps. We have many examples of that already. The Oregon OSHA program and Bureau of Labor and Industries has programs along these lines as well. Development of coordinated and consistent compliance strategy of preventative and corrective tools such as joint rulemaking by the agencies, joint auditing to avoid multiple audits, institution of the web-based or hotline for compliance information and reporting, and development of an explanatory notice that may be used to educate employers, workers, and the public of the implications of being an independent contractor. So these are all tools that would be available. In closing, I'd like to note two things. First, we've achieved agreement on a new definition for purposes of the Employment Department and the Revenue Department. And we were near agreement on how to best incorporate the Workers' Comp Division. Because we could not reach total agreement on the Workers' Comp element by our deadline for our task force report, that remaining work was left up to the Workers' Comp Division to finalize a recommendation. And that recommendation has gone before the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and later you'll hear about that proposed amendment that would include the Workers' Comp Division into this bill. Second and lastly, I must point out a major concern, and that is if nothing is done this session, Senate Bill 232 from 2003 will go into effect, and the result would be an old definition that would still apply to the Employment Department, a new definition that would apply to the Department of Revenue, and a court case law that affected the definition for the workers' comp section. So this would not only give us the obvious of three definitions for three agencies, but it would also adversely impact the current combined tax registration process that is a great service to employers and to the state agencies. And with that, I'll turn it over to Elizabeth to walk you through the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go ahead, Ms. Harshenko.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I served on this committee in the capacity as the governor's representative. The Revenue Department was represented by my deputy, Susan Browning. So I'm still here in that capacity, I think, as governor's representative, and I have provided a highlight of the elements of the bill, and I'll be happy to just walk you through section by section. Sections 1 and 2 are pretty close to identical. They both amend ORS 670-600, which is the statute that set forth the existing definition of independent contractor. The legislature, as Lisa pointed out to you, made a change to that statute effective January 1, 2006, and so legislative council felt that to be perfectly careful and cover all the bases, needed to amend both versions, the current law version and the one that was supposed to go into effect in 2006. So the new language in Section 1 and Section 2 is identical. Basically, what the bill does is repeal all of the old language of the law and start fresh in terms of language, and defines some basic terms that are used in the bill. An individual, that means a natural person, a human being. Person, the legal definition, which includes business entities such as corporations and partnerships under Oregon law. And then what constitutes services, that we mean labor and other kinds of services that might be provided by an independent contractor. The core of the statute is the definition itself. And the elements are that an independent contractor is someone who provides services for pay, who is free from direction and control of the person for whom those services are being provided, who is engaged in an independently established business, who has appropriate licenses for construction or landscaping. There's a particular reference in the statute to ORS Chapter 671 and 701. Or who, if some other license or certificate is required in order to be able to provide services, is responsible to obtain those licenses or certificates. So those are the five pieces that any person who holds himself out as being an independent contractor will have to meet under the statute. The statute then goes on to explain how you demonstrate that you have an independently established business. And this, I think, is the heart of the work that the task force did. What are the criteria that are basic enough that they can apply to a wide variety of different kinds of business activities, whether it's construction trades or services or technology-based or medical? And so there was a lot of discussion in the group about what the criteria ought to be, how those ought to be structured, and how many of the available criteria should be satisfied. So the statute provides that any three out of the five criteria specified must be met to show that an individual is engaged in an independently established business in order to satisfy that part of that five-element test for showing that you are an independent contractor. The five criteria are that the contractor has an identifiable business location that's separate from the location of the person for whom the services are provided. And you can show that one of two ways. Either you've got an office somewhere where you have office space, or if you're operating out of your home, you can identify some place in your home where you actually carry on those activities. The contractor has to be the one who bears the risk of loss. If the services or work product don't meet the results that are expected by the person for whom the services are being provided. And that can be demonstrated in a number of different ways under the statute. But basically it is that if I'm an independent contractor and I'm doing work for you and I agree I'm going to produce this result for you, if there's a defect in the product or something that's wrong with the service, I have to make it good and I bear the risk of the economic loss of doing that. I'm not on a salary where you pay me in order to fix my mistake. The third criteria is that the contractor provides services to two or more customers in a year, in a 12-month period, or they advertise and solicit business or market their business in order to obtain those customers. The fourth is that the contractor has a significant investment in the business, and that is demonstrated by some listed components such as purchasing and providing tools or equipment that's needed in order for them to provide the service, paying for the premises or facilities where they perform the services, or paying for licenses, certificates, or specialized training in order to provide the services. The fifth element, of the five criteria, is that the contractor is the one who has the right to hire or fire assistants in order to perform the contracted service. So if I'm a contractor and I'm coming to provide a service for you, I can bring my own employees with me to provide that service. You can't tell me who I can hire or fire and bring and have on the job. That's my role. And that is another criteria that could demonstrate that the person is, in fact, engaged in an independent business, independent from the business that is receiving service from that person. So the contractor has to demonstrate three out of five of those criteria in order to meet that independently established business test. There is an exception in the legislation for farm labor or farm services. They don't have to show that they satisfy the risk of loss requirement. And moving on into page 3 of Senate Bill 323, line 14 through 21, one of the concerns that was discussed by the group was what impact does the fact that someone who is offering services as an independent contractor creates a business entity through which those services are provided, a partnership, a corporation, a limited liability company, would that be an automatic indicator that there is an independent business here and that the person who has created that entity is not functioning as an employee? The group agreed that that creation of an independent entity in and of itself would not necessarily insulate the individual from being an employee if their behavior was, in fact, they were subject to direction and control by whoever they were performing the services for, or they couldn't show meeting three out of the five of the five criteria for independently established business. At the same time, it wouldn't be an automatic presumption, but if someone had created a separate entity through which services are provided, that the test could be established in part by the individual and part by the entity. For example, if I'm providing services through a limited liability company or a corporation, and I have to have a particular license, and the entity has to have the license, I can satisfy the criteria by showing that my corporation has the necessary license, say a contractor's, general contractor's license, and has made the investment by securing the bond for my services, for example. So that way the entity, if that's the contract that who has signed the contract, the criteria can be satisfied in part by the entity and part by the individual, however that's most appropriate. The third section in the bill, which is on page 5, amends existing law, ORS 670605, which specified that the agencies that are subject to this statute were to adopt rules together to carry it out, and it adds to that requirement that those agencies are to cooperate in compliance and enforcement activities and to ensure consistent interpretation and application of the law. And what I would like to report to you, Lisa identified the five activities that those agencies proposed to the task force that they engage in anticipation that the legislature will favorably consider this legislation. Revenue, workers' comp, and employment are already working together. We have a work group that's put together and has already begun to meet to work on the website and the other elements that were proposed in the report of the task force that would assist businesses, those who contract for services and those who provide services, employers and employees in knowing where the lines are, how to figure out whether they satisfy the criteria to be either an employee or to be an independent contractor, and to start to remove some of the confusion that's out there right now. So we have started already in the hopes that that this bill will be enacted. Section 4 amends ORS 657040, which is in the Employment Department statutes, and conforms that statute to the work of the task force by providing that if an individual is an independent contractor as defined in ORS 670600, that's going to be the determination that what determines that they are not an employee for purposes of unemployment insurance. In the past, the statute had two tests in the alternative, either the statute or freedom from direction and control and being engaged in independently established business, both of which terms were being judicially interpreted. And now the employment statute points back to this statute. Section 5 repeals ORS 314013, which is the Senate Bill 232, different definition that had been created for the Department of Revenue that will not become effective at all if this bill passes. Section 6 is a conforming amendment. This is a statute that is administered by the Department of Revenue, and it's related to senior citizens' property tax deferral. There was on line 19 on page 6, you'll see simply removing the reference to 314013 because that is being repealed by the bill. There's no substantive policy change in that statute. Section 7 of the bill points the Department of Revenue at this new definition, and that's actually where that happens is on page 7 of the bill on line 12. Section 8 prescribes the effective date that this new definition will apply for income tax purposes to income tax years and withholding reporting tax periods, which of course employers are concerned about, beginning on or after January 1, 2006. and that for purposes of the rest of the amendments, that those apply only to services provided on or after the effective date, and the normal effective date of legislation is January 1, so that would also be January 1, 2006. Are there any questions about the bill as introduced?
Questions?
Then I would like to just explain for you the proposed dash two amendments that Senator Walker referred to when she addressed you. Those amendments, Senate Bill 323-2, dated February 22. Those amendments would create a section of legislative findings that would assist, we hope, the courts in understanding that the intention of the legislature is to bring, and I believe it's really four agencies because of the fact that the Construction Contractors Board already points at 670-600 in part for its definition of independent contractor. So revenue, employment, workers' compensation, if the dash one amendments are included, and construction contractors together under one definition of independent contractor, that the intention of the legislature is to provide consistent and predictable application of the definition and consistent and predictable interpretation by the agencies, a desire to provide clear guidelines for business and workers and to achieve greater compliance with the requirements for independent contractor status, and that it's important for the legislature, I think, one of the reasons why subsection 3 is in here, is there is a body of case law by the courts interpreting and applying this statute and other statutes that affect who is an independent contractor and who is an employee. And the legislature, if this language is adopted, would acknowledge the existence of that case law and inform the court that the intention of the changes is not to go off in a whole brand new direction, but to take advantage of what case law is already there for purposes of parts of the law where the legislature has used either the same language or very, very similar concepts, again, for the idea that we've got a body of case law that a lot of the folks who advise businesses understand, and we want to take advantage of that rather than having to have the courts now interpret this all brand new. So it's not intended to be a major change in the application of those specific tests where those concepts or that language still exist in the law. And so that would be the purpose of the statement of findings. I'd be very happy to answer any questions about the bill, and if you have any additional questions about the work of the agencies, I can address those as well.
Thank you very much. Ms. Trussell, when do we anticipate time frame for to get MLAC's view of the workers' comp piece for this?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, MLAC, the workers' comp division brought a proposal in front of MLAC, and it was conceptually agreed to, and they were working on getting amendments drafted. So, assuming, I'm not sure if the amendments are ready yet or not, but I think that they do have a proposal that would work in this bill. The thing is, I think it's really key and important to do to remember is that if we can include the workers' comp division fix, that would be wonderful. But if for some reason that's not available, the bill as it's written would be an improvement over what will happen January 1st without a bill. But it would be nice if we could include the workers' comp piece. And I believe they're here today, but I don't know if they have a piece.
Yeah. Like I say, I was just trying to get a feel for time frame when that might be, how that might be organized. Well, appreciate your work on this. Yeah, I've heard this for the last couple of sessions, too. And I remember all the work on that last session. And so I realize how complex an issue it is and appreciate all the efforts you folks have put into that. Any other questions before we dismiss these folks? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask Jerry, Jeff, and Norman to come forward. We've had an explanation of the bill, and they're not here. Okay, fine. Mark them off the list. Then the last next one is Patrick Allen.
Thank you.
don't look like Patrick Allen. Okay. So you guys are here. You just weren't speaking up. Well, you know.
Good afternoon.
Please proceed. We got about 20 minutes left, so.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Manahan. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appear here today to request committee support for Senate Bill 323. And I'd like to just reiterate some of the testimony you've already heard. Employers and workers have consistently had trouble understanding how the state agencies would apply an independent contractor determination as to whether or not they were a worker or an independent contractor. The workers' compensation test currently is different than what the same test you would get if you were looking under employment law. And that was a result of case law that basically said under workers' compensation, you first look to see whether someone is a worker before you would take a look to see, determine whether or not there was an independent contractor relationship. And under workers' compensation, a worker is basically someone who is free from the direction and control of another person. So the common law test applies for workers' compensation. And an example where we see that is in what we call non-complying employers, where an individual has someone working with them, believing that other person is an independent contractor. If we find that that person is under the direction and control, that business has to have workers' compensation insurance. And without the insurance, they're considered a non-complying employer. And they would be personally liable for any claims that may result from an injury under that circumstance. We also have the same circumstance where a person may believe they are a worker, and we find that, in fact, they are an independent contractor. So they have trouble understanding which test applies to them. We believe this bill will assist in clarifying that for both businesses and for individuals and workers as well. One of the things in the bill that it does, it really incorporates the test that workers' compensation uses today, which is the common law test from freedom of direction and control, into employment law under 670-600. So the test that we use in workers' compensation today will also and is to be used for the employment law test. So we're really looking at the same test, although it's applying to 670-600 under the employment law. And what we would like to be able to do is to make sure we can link workers' compensation law to the employment law, so it's real clear that when you look to determine whether someone is a worker or an independent contractor, we will use the same test as the employment and revenue. The major change that we see is that we will also, in addition to the right of direction control, we will now also be looking at whether or not they have an established business, which currently we don't do under the workers' compensation system. But with the changes proposed in Senate Bill 323, we really believe the current practices that workers' compensation uses under common law is going to be very consistent with what Senate Bill 323 proposes. We're not seeing any significant change. We're not seeing any changes that would cause more workers, for example, to be now determined independent contractors, and vice versa. We're not seeing any change for businesses either. We believe it's more of a clarification and an understanding for both businesses and labor. We have requested an amendment to Senate Bill 323 from Legislative Council. They have been working on the amendment, and the amendment basically is to change the workers' compensation definition of worker to basically say that you're a person who's under the, if they're under direction and control, they're either a worker, unless they meet this test under employment law establishing them as an independent contractor. So it really incorporates that test into the workers' compensation law to make sure that when we look at that relationship, we will use the employment department's test, the same as employment and revenue and other agencies. Legislative Council has advised that because of changing the definition of worker, the link to the employment law, there's some other conforming language they have to adjust to make that happen. But the whole intent there is strictly to make the link to the test under employment law and not to change any other aspect of workers' compensation. The right of direction control remains. However, we will now add the other business test through the employment department. They have been working on the language. We were hoping we would have had it for the committee today. With that, I respectfully request your support for Senate Bill 323 with the amendments to link workers' compensation with the other agencies. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to go to our next two witnesses and just keep an imaginary time frame. I know we have some written testimony, so I would really appreciate that you point out something new. You know, if everything else is just an affirmation is fine. We don't need to plow old ground, but if you have some new parts about this you want to bring to our attention, I would try to really touch on those. So please proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeffrey Chacoin. I'm an employment attorney. I represent businesses and employers in Oregon with the law firm of Newcomb, Sabin, Schwartz, and Landsberg. I've served as a member of the task force, and I'm here to tell you from an employer's lawyer's perspective that I find that Senate Bill 323 is a good bill. Succeeds in doing what we were trying to accomplish and would recommend it. And in the interest of time, I won't go into any more detail. I do support Senate Bill 323 as proposed. I have to tell you, though, the dash one amendments proposed by the Workers' Compensation Agency, as Mr. Monahan was describing, were not part of the package, and we left them out on purpose because we were uncertain of the effect and had not had input from the workers' compensation community. And so we left those out, and I just want to make sure you understand that.
Sure.
My endorsement is for Senate Bill 323 as proposed.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Norman Malbin. I was a member of the task force. I'm a designated labor representative. I'm in-house counsel to IBEW Local 48, labor attorney for 20 years, and prior to that worked at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I want to highlight a couple of things. A lot of what the legislature has heard the last few sessions regarding independent contractors and is the disparity between Oregon law and federal law, and poor contractors who get caught being told they're in compliance with federal law and then getting hung up in Oregon law and being told that they're not in compliance, and oh gee, the poor contractor. I come from the other end. I see the other end of the spectrum. Lisa Trussell accurately identified. There is another side of the story. What I see are the contractors who intentionally cheat. They intentionally cheat in a variety of ways to get ahead in business. They will classify a worker as an independent contractor in order to avoid paying workers' comp, in order to avoid paying their roll-up on taxes, in order to avoid paying company benefits, in order to avoid paying overtime. The federal law is basically a right to control test. Oregon law has the right to control test. In the late 80s, Oregon legislature added what we call bright line tests to make it easy to identify. It was a 4 out of 6 kind of criteria, and now it's a 3 out of 5. When I sat down with the head of the tax section, I found out that we were philosophically 180 degrees apart. He wanted all of his clients to have as many independent contractors as he wanted. I opposed him on a matter of policy because the fewer workers that we have that have the protections of workers' comp or unemployment or overtime or employers collecting taxes, I just don't think that's good for society. We disagreed philosophically, but when we sat down and talked about individual examples of who is an independent contractor, what I found out, I didn't have it as often with Jeff, but I have it frequently with John Dranius, who's the head of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar. We agreed every time. And so we didn't talk philosophy. We talked, rules. And the rules that we ultimately came up with modernized them to some extent. Technology has changed. People don't have home phone lines the way they used to. Don't have necessarily have business cards or fax lines the way they used to. The way people do business, small business, has changed. This is a compromise. What's important is that it's a consensus. It was 100% unanimous consensus by everybody on the committee, and we felt pretty proud of that, and we recommend that be passed.
Thank you very much. Questions of these folks? Okay, thank you very much. Patrick Allen, Chris Davey. And our first person with concerns coming forward, and another supporter. And again, we'll continue this part of the hearing until 2 o'clock. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. 90 seconds or less, I promise. I'm here today, I think, to put a regulatory streamlining exclamation point on this bill. I've been before this committee and lots of others talking about 37 streamlining bills we have this session, of which this is one. Usually I'm before committee saying these are really small changes that by themselves don't amount to a lot, but together make a big difference. This is not one of those bills. Indeed, this is probably one of the very most important regulatory streamlining bills in that 37 bill package that you'll see this session. As we've been doing regulatory streamlining, there have been two overarching themes that have come through loud and clear from businesses about the state's regulatory environment. One is that is the cumulative impacts of multiple regulations from different agencies with different standards and different definitions that all land on the same business. And the second is the complexity of regulations that impact employers, especially new employers or small businesses that are first getting into the issue of having employees. Senate Bill 323 really goes directly at both those problems. Assuming that the Dash 1 amendments that Jerry Manahan spoke of pass muster with MLAC, you'll have a situation, if the bill passes, of a single set of tests for all employers, whether they're dealing with the Employment Department or Revenue Department or Workers' Comp. So the issues will be the same, and the definitions of contractor will be the same. It'll take a system that's really very, very complicated and make it much more straightforward, and it'll do so without reducing protections for workers in terms of employment or workers' compensation. And again, especially I want to emphasize that that is especially true for very small employers and very small businesses that are hiring their first employee or two and don't have access as often to legal counsel or human resources department or somebody else to help them with those definitional issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Davey, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I'll see if I can beat Mr. Allen's 90 seconds. As you heard, this bill was drafted initially without including workers' compensation, and the workers' compensation definition of who is an independent contractor has always been unique. It's been litigated over the years, and it's pretty now well settled as to how those cases are interpreted. I understand there is now an intent to bring workers' compensation under this single umbrella, and that makes sense, that businesses would be able to just look at a single definition that would suit all purposes. I just want to point out that if we are doing that, then and you're redrawing where the line is between a worker and an independent contractor to some extent, then inevitably some people are going to slip from one side of the line to the other. So there may be some changes in how workers' comp cases are adjudicated. There has been some discussion about the fact that there is a common law test that's used in workers' compensation, and that there was an attempt to write into this bill that test. I also heard that there was to be a preamble that would make that more clear, and I think that's one of the amendments that I was handed and haven't had a chance to read. Also, you've not seen, and I have not seen, the amendment that brings workers' compensation under this bill also. So we'll look forward to seeing those amendments and making sure that they make this work as smoothly as possible, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Davey, your second point about ORS 670.60, you're concerned about the danger that the new subsection 3 could be viewed as a list of elements. Would you elaborate on that a bit?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's just a matter of the structure of the bill. And in subsection 2A on page 2, it talks about whether a person is free from direction and control over the means and manner of providing the services. And then in subsection 3, it appears to give a list of elements that would indicate some sort of freedom from direction and control. And so if that list is to be used for the purpose of looking also at the direction and control issue, I think there just needs to be a little clearer linkage in the bill to show that you look at that list, but there may be other factors included too.
Okay. Questions for either John? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Schellenberg and Mr. Glad, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. You mentioned a little earlier about plowing old ground, and that goes to the heart.
I'm thinking of you, Don.
Goes to the heart of the issue that I want to address here today. On page 3, Ms. Harshenko went through the bill with you and indicated that there was a specific provision for agriculture, indicating that farmers were independent contractors, and it said if they file a Schedule F. And then on line 12 on page 3, it says, and the person provides farm labor services, that would be custom farming. So it depends whether I'm plowing just my ground and my neighbor's ground, or whether I don't have any in my own ground and I'm only plowing my neighbor's ground. That makes me a custom farmer. And the way this reads, and I have to give credit to the agencies because they've not misinterpreted this in the past, but this bill is intended to clarify things, and so I would suggest that we want to make this very clear. It says here that you have to file both a Schedule F and a Schedule C. If you're a farmer and only farming your own and for your neighbor only, you only do a Schedule F. You don't do a Schedule C. Or if you don't have any farm of your own, but you do custom work for other farmers, such as baling straw and hay and that kind of thing, you only file a Schedule C. You don't file a Schedule F. This indicates you need to do both. What we would like to suggest is on line 12, after the word and, you add the word or, slash or. Now, I don't know if Ledge Council lets you do slash or not. I don't know how they do that, but
slash or, that's pretty tough.
that's the issue that we'd like to bring for you today. That amendment would also need to be made on page 5, line 15. So we respectively request that amendment and would support the bill based on that amendment. Right. Thank you.
In a moment, I'll ask for someone to come up and discuss that. So thank you. Let's go to Mr. Glad here.
Very quickly, my name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent 5,000 carpenters in the state of Oregon and 500,000 carpenters nationwide. Misclassification of workers and independent contractors is a premier issue with carpenters throughout the land, that employers have been moving in a direction in recent years to increase the underground economy, the cash economy in the construction industry, particularly in the drywall industry. And it has created a tremendous need for us to be able to get our hands around not only the definitions but the enforcements of who is and who is not an employee, who is and who is not an independent contractor. I had the opportunity to sit with this task force, and I support 323 in its fullest as it is written today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Harshenko, would you come up? Just stay there, Don. Mr. Schellenberg, I don't know if you happened to hear his testimony.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Elizabeth Harshenko, Revenue Department. I was out in the hall.
Well, Mr. Schellenberg was referring to lines, page 3, line 12, 11, 12, and 13. And rather than me try to explain it, Don, if you would just briefly bring up your point again, and we'll ask the department's reaction to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau, and Ms. Harshenko and I think have discussed this before. The word and, it indicates that you have to fill out both a Schedule F and a Schedule C. And in our case, you need to only do one or the other, or you may need to do both, but you don't always have to do both, and this indicates you have to do both. So in the spirit of clarification, we're asking that that would be an and slash or, if legislative council can use slashes. So it indicates you can do one or the other or both.
Tell me your perspective of that issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in a former life, I worked for legislative counsel, and I remember Kathleen Beaufay teaching me we don't do and/or, but I understand the concern. We've got some other things that are sort of in the air, have some concerns that have been expressed, and what I would like to suggest is that if we could have a little bit of time and work with Mr. Schellenberg on his issue and work with some of the others who have some concerns around some of the language that's being offered in the dash ones, and then come back with a solution to the committee, that that might be the most efficient use of your time.
Yeah, we would appreciate doing that, because we don't want to have any, you know, since we have other stuff in the works here on this bill, and we want to make sure that it's right when it comes out. Questions for any of these folks? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, last testimony, signing that, Michael Dale, if you want to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Worker Justice Project. I apologize for not having written testimony today. I hadn't intended to testify because my principal concern came up at this hearing. I did want to mention this. At the Northwest Worker Justice Project, one of the things we're particularly concerned about is the plight of contingent workers, by which we mean all those people that work as hard as they can but don't have a job. They're classified as independent contractors who are standing on the street corner waiting to be hired and so forth. We do have some concerns with the proposal of changing, of incorporating the independent contractor definition as an exclusion from the workers' comp test for a covered employer. There is Oregon case law. The most recent case, I happen to represent the worker in the in the Oregon Supreme Court case, In Re Rubel Caba. I can follow up with a cite to it. Basically, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the idea that part of the test for who's a covered worker under workers' comp law is what's called the nature of the work test. And with all due respect to the representative from workers' comp here, the test in Oregon is not the common law control test. It's the common law control test augmented by the nature of the work test. The nature of the work test, to try to put it as simply as it can, uses some factors to try to decide whether this, quote, independent business is one that is likely to be able to pass the insurance risk of industrial injury on through the stream of commerce. And if it's not, then that person is not not on their own in terms of workers' compensation. My concern is my client, Mr. Rubel Caba, who was essentially 26 weeks out of the year a field worker in the farming industry, but had saved enough money to buy a truck. So 6 weeks out of the year, he was a contract hauler, and wound up losing his arm in an accident in a conveyor belt, and was initially held not to be an employee. Mr. Rubel Caba would be an independent contractor and exempt under the statute. It is a change. It is a change that affects some of the most marginalized workers, and I would caution the committee to move very slowly in that regard. The other concern I'd like to raise for you is more one that I don't really quite understand, and that is the provision that Mr. Schellenberg referred to. I'm not sure if it applies to farm labor contractors, and if it does, how it applies or what it means. I think the language is unclear, and would be happy to work with that group in terms of trying to clarify that this somehow doesn't make all farm labor contractors independent contractors, because many of them really it is the farmer who's currently responsible for workers' comp coverage, and we would want to maintain that.
Thank you, Mr. Questions for Mr. Dale? One thing I would ask is, since everyone in the room, and we are working on amendments trying to clarify some of these things that still are out there and roaming. So, Mr. Dale, you know, it's incumbent on you as well to work with Teresa here to articulate some of your concerns, and working with the department and the the task force members so that we can articulate all of these concerns and what's real, what isn't real, and if the ones that are real, how we're going to correct them. And then we will be bringing the bill back and moving at that point, but we want to do this in a judicious time frame. So Ms. Benwick will be the conduit for that information.
If I may, Senator Metzger, I'd be happy to submit follow-up written testimony just to sort of
that would be helpful.
So you have.
That would be helpful and imply that. Make sure that we try to cover all the bases here. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so this bill will be coming back. We're going to wait to get those amendments. For anyone in the audience, if there's other questions, I think the key people have been working on this, and we appreciate all their work. Let's go through Mrs. Van Winkle here as we formulate these amendments and make sure that we have covered the things that we have asked to do in this. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And we'll move into the work session part of our agenda and open up a work session on Senate Bill 207. Teresa, why don't you remind us of this one?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 207 requires insurance companies to receive a return receipt when canceling or terminating certain types of insurance by electronic record. If the insurer does not receive a return receipt from the consumer, the policy may be canceled or terminated only after providing or delivering the notice in writing to the consumer. We heard this bill on February 15th. There's no fiscal impact or revenue impact, and there are no amendments before you.
Okay. Does everybody remember this bill and make sure when you're on electronic contact that you have to have a return or send it by mail to make sure that no one misses? We didn't have any opposition on that. So if that's if everybody is satisfied with that, then I'd entertain a motion to move that bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
I enthusiastically move Senate Bill 207 to the floor with a strong do-pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Decker has moved Senate Bill 207 to the floor with a strong do-pass recommendation. Discussion by the committee? Any objections? So ordered. And since you're so strong, I think you'll be the carrier. How's that?
Your Mom Sanderson was
well,
no, I think you're very strongly in favor.
Okay.
Was this Vicky's?
Yes, it was.
Oh,
she wanted to.
Oh, yeah, I think she wanted to carry. I'll check.
Oh, she did. Okay.
I believe so.
Well, we will give Senator Walker the opportunity first, and then if not, we'll defer to Senator Decker. Okay. So we'll close the work session on 207, open work session, Senate Bill 318. Teresa.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 318 authorizes the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board to discipline license or permit holders who are unable to safely conduct the practice of veterinary medicine. This bill was heard on February 10th. There's no fiscal or revenue impact. There are -1 amendments before you which were requested by the examining board. It does two things. It will increase the number of board members who consent before disciplining any or permit or license holder under the provisions of this bill from 4 to 5 members. It also adds a provision that before the board may discipline any permit or license holder for a physical or mental condition that makes the permit or license holder unsafe to safely conduct practice, the permit or license holder shall undergo a physical or mental health evaluation.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the -1.
Senator Atkinson has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 318. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill as amended to the floor.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 318 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion?
You got someone waving out here.
Yes.
May I?
You may approach. We're in a work session, but we'll let you approach.
This is like the 7th veterinary board bill I've seen. You guys have been busy.
We're busy a little.
Please identify yourself.
For the record, Lori Mockinen, director of the veterinary board. Mr. Chair and members, I want to make it very clear that the amendment that has been presented by legislative council changed one word, and it changed direction to order. And it's more or less a semantic change, but we originally wrote it as direction so that there would never be any confusion about whether that is order verb or order noun with a large O. What we don't want to have this interpreted as would be that the board has to issue a proposed order in order to compel a physical or mental exam. We want this to be very clear that this is order in the same sense that the board asks for patient records in an investigation. So I want to make sure that doesn't get misinterpreted.
Okay. it's not misinterpreted as far as I'm concerned, but I mean, if you did you discuss that with legislative council?
Did.
And they said?
Charlie Cheek said that he's comfortable with direction. Yeah. Our AG, Carol Parks, looked at the thesaurus and found that order, direction, and instruction are all pretty much the same thing. So I would be happy with leaving it at direction, but if the committee wants to keep it at order, that would be okay.
Well, I think what we'll do here is, because legislative council feels that this does the same thing in their list of verbiage, but what I would do here is just if under further examination you think there's a real issue with that, of course this will be going over to the House and we'll have a chance to do that again, but my understanding is the same that you heard, is that we're doing the same thing.
Yes,
so,
Mr. Chair, that's the understanding I received from Ledge Council as well.
So, you know, if that changes, then, you know, we would certainly be supportive of reopening that discussion when this goes to Senator or Representative Brownsman. Is that okay with you?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we've adopted the dash one. Now we're looking for the bill itself, right?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill as amended to the floor.
Okay.
To do pass.
Senator Atkins has moved Senate Bill 318 as amended to the floor. It's a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? For order. Okay.
How about Senator Schrader carrying
the... Well, let's do that. Let's ask Senator Schrader, because that way we'll know we'll get a yes vote out of him, you know, on the floor. Okay. We'll open up work session on Senate Bill 367. Teresa, do you want to go through the dash two amendments we have here?
To refresh your memory, Senate Bill 367 requires drivers and passengers in privately owned commercial vehicles designed and used to transport 15 or fewer persons to use safety belts and exempts such vehicles from requiring child safety seats. There are dash two amendments in front of you. It will exempt taxi cab operators to be properly secured with a safety belt or safety harness and exempt commercial vehicle operators to ensure that a passenger is properly secured with a child safety system. It also amends current statute to add that passengers and drivers of privately owned commercial vehicles are liable for safety belt violations and places liability on the passenger responsible for a minor who is not properly secured with a child safety system.
Okay, thank you. As you remember, this was the this was the bill that we had when we were in Hillsborough, and as you recall, everyone testified in support of the bill, but there was two concerns. One was articulated by some of those in the industry who were concerned about their personal safety because of the type of clientele they would pick up at all hours of the night, and so we decided that we would acknowledge that from the taxi folks and exempt them from that requirement. Keeping in mind that it's still a good policy to do that, you know, the folks from Radio Cab who testified, and by the way, they submitted a letter to folks who testified in support of the bill as amended, that they say in the most cases they do, in fact, buckle up their seatbelt, but they wanted to have that option because they couldn't really control the type of personnel. So we acknowledge that in the amendment and exempted the driver from that. The second one was in drafting the bill had originally, as Teresa mentioned, exempted the child safety seat because we didn't want a bunch of taxi cab people feeling they had to buy a bunch of child seats and stick them in their trunk. But it was also brought up by people that, hey, you know, we want child restraint. So the question is, who is be responsible? And so what the amendment does is say, yes, if you have a minor child that fits that description, they have to be in a safety seat. But it is the responsibility of the parent, not the operator of the vehicle, to provide those. So most people carry their seat with them for their child and make sure they're safely done, and that has to be done, but it will be the adult who is responsible, not the operator of the vehicle, responsible for making sure that happens. Now, since we're in work session here, but I'm going to make one change, is that we had a young lady, and Ms. Whitman, you want to come forward? And she's been waiting patiently here with her folks. She had heard about this issue and talked to Representative Billy Dalto and decided to do a research project. And so I thought before we voted on the bill that we would actually give Ms. Whitman an opportunity to come forward and just tell us what she did, because I was very impressed with your diligence on this, and you found about it after the hearing. So if you could give us a brief summary of what you've done, we would appreciate that, Ms. Whitman. And just identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Krista K. Whitman. My address is in Salem, Oregon. In 1999, 11.5% of the rear seat taxi passengers involved in crashes sustained injuries such as fractures, concussions, internal injuries, bleedings, and burns. Only 17% of backseat passengers who were involved in crashes in 1999 were wearing seatbelts. Taxi passengers not wearing a restraint were nearly two times as likely to sustain severe injuries as those who were wearing a restraint. There were over 130,000 taxi and livery crashes between 1990 and 1999. Schaller Consulting reported all of these facts in New York City. I think that passengers in taxis should have to wear their seatbelts. The reason why is because seatbelts are already in taxis. Why does any average citizen in their own transportation have to click in a ticket? $97 is how much you would have to pay if you don't click it. Why is it acceptable to lawmakers to allow citizens' lives to be risked in taxi cabs but not in citizens' cars? Are people's lives less valuable in taxi cabs than in cars? I have roughly brought with me here today 110 letters from concerned citizens at Hauck Middle School, and I also have a petition from concerned citizens at Hauck Middle School, and I have a letter that an eighth grader wrote and how he felt on this issue. He said, "Yes, I think there should be a law to enforce wearing seatbelts. Studies have been shown that seatbelts save lives, so apparently people's lives in taxi cabs don't matter. But people should use common sense, but then some people don't care. But a law would save more lives." Signed by Jameson Fitzsimmons. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Whitman. We appreciate your interest in legislation in the Capitol. Any questions for Ms. Whitman?
Great job. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Now, I asked Mr. Costales to be here if there was any other further questions. Senator Atkins, you were not at our hearing in Hillsborough on this bill. So I'll right now open up for any discussion by
Why is it the role of the police to go around and check who's buckled up in taxi cabs? I don't know if I like that part of it, the enforcement side of it.
Well, I don't think, Senator, that they're out after taxi cabs any more than you or I to be out looking for anything. We did hear from the police and the taxi cab industry that they wanted their passengers buckled up. I don't think there was anything, any testimony that they were going to be targeted any differently than any other citizen on that. Mr. Costales, you want to come forward just for, in case you have some other questions? Go ahead, Senator Atkins, do you have some?
I mean, hear from the advocate. I didn't know this was a huge problem in Oregon. I mean, go ahead.
Mr. Costales.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think it might be helpful if you might give us a brief summary of our hearing from the safety side on this, and also in terms of the safety figures with the seatbelt, which of course was passed, well, I guess it's almost 20 years ago now, in Oregon, and give us maybe a brief summation of that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The safety belt law in the state of Oregon is the only one in the United States that was actually voted in by the citizenry. In 1990, the Oregon citizens voted safety belt law in, and since that time, we've seen our safety belt use rate go from roughly 50% to where this past year, in looking at what overall safety belt use rate is, it was 94%, which puts us in the top four in the United States, if not in the top dozen across the world. Our safety belt law is what's considered a primary offense or law. A law enforcement officer can see someone without a safety belt on and can stop them. Many states have what's called secondary law, which means they have to be stopped for a different offense before they can be cited for a safety belt violation. We also have one of the strongest child passenger safety set of laws in the United States as well, in relationship to children under the age of 4 being an approved safety seat, and those up through 6 and 60 pounds in some sort of booster seat can appropriately have the safety belt come across the front of their chest and not behind their back or across their neck. This bill came about is due to the crash in the Portland area with the shuttle van, which in the law there's a list of 9 or 10 exemptions. Privately owned commercial vehicles, the taxis, limos, shuttles that are built, designed, and used for 15 or fewer passengers have been exempt from the law. And this committee brought forward this bill in order to close that loop for passengers that are in taxicab, limos, and airport shuttle vans. Safety belts save lives. A lap belt alone has a 50% effective rate of reducing or limiting death or injury. Lap and shoulder belt is 65% effective in reducing death or injury. And child safety seat is in the 70% effective of reducing death or injury in traffic crash. And in relationship to possibly addressing Senator Atkinson's question about law enforcement, Senator, from a law enforcement point of view, there's not, you know, I did not hear anybody testify or heard anybody come forward to our office indicating that they would have a special program out there to target the vehicles that are being talked about. In fact, some of the companies that we're talking about have as a policy for their insurance purposes and also for safety of the passengers that they have a please use request and have talked about that this would help them with further background in order to let their passengers know that they are now required to wear belts instead of just as a courtesy. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's other items about the bill or the law that I could try and help for you.
Yes, yes.
Wouldn't this apply to, like, in my district we have dial-a-ride for senior citizens that go into town once a week for medical checkups, and we have similar type of van services for people who have a variety of health issues. And it's not to say they don't wear their seatbelt now, but has this been an overwhelming problem?
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, this only addresses privately owned commercial vehicles designed and used for 15 or fewer passengers. Some of the vehicles that I believe you're addressing are publicly owned.
So if you ride on a public one, you don't have to?
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, that is correct. That the public ones are still exempt from the law.
That's not fair. I mean, we just heard someone argue that if you ride in a taxi cab, according to Oregon law, you're less valuable than if you ride in somebody's car. Well, so you're saying that you're more valuable if you ride in a public car or a private car, but less in a public? Sorry to be difficult, but I didn't know this was a big problem.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can answer the question. This is a legislatively sponsored bill eliminating one of the list of exemptions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Costello. Okay. I think just kind of reviewing where we were, this bill originated actually from the incident in Portland with the figure skater's mom when we came to an understanding, and I think in the coverage of that also pointed out it was surprising that even though we have mandatory seatbelts, when there was an exemption for commercial drivers had been put in because of UPS drivers and FedEx, and so the people who were just hopping in and out were not transporting passengers, but when they used that definition of commercial drivers, it caught those people in that. And like a lot of things we do in the legislature, until you have a tragedy and realize that what you think is a safety restraint system, and particularly the automobiles now, which are designed for those belts to work with, for the airbags in the front seat, et cetera, and side bags to be used with the safety belt. I always find it interesting when I go a lot of places, but particularly D.C., they have a very big sign on the back of the seat. I mean, it must have your passengers belted up. And our folks from the taxi cab industry who had pointed out that they, for the very reason they didn't want to be belted because they had some threatening situations, they wanted to make sure their passengers were as well, not only for the safety point, but for their safety themselves. So that's just kind of a brief, summation of that. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Troy. I think what we're going to do here is we're going to have to be in recess for a moment, I think. Is that correct, Senator Atkinson? If you're not, we have to be in recess.
Okay.
We're going to take a brief recess until Senator Deckert returns in. I think he's just outside the door, Senator. And we have -2 amendments on Senate Bill 367. Vice Chair Starr's gone. Senator Monta Sanderson, would you mind moving the -2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 367.
Okay. Senator Monta Sanderson has moved the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 367. Discussion on the -2s. Any objection to the -2s? Okay. Sorry. Senator Monta Sanderson.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 367 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson has moved Senate Bill 367 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Decker.
Thank you. So I'll just say, you know, just for the record, because I remember the very good testimony and the lengthy hearing we had it up in Hillsborough on this, and it was certainly an interesting issue. The one thing that occurred to me with this child seat issue, other than the legitimate concerns that the taxi cab drivers had, and was my hope is, and I just put this out there, is that when you have those real extreme circumstances that we talked about, where you might have a mother with three children and one car seat or two car seat that's low income, and the cab driver mentioned, I think it was after the hearing, that sometimes we take those folks to the store once a month. So my hope would be that we've enacted this, but we still, cab drivers, since it's ultimately the parent that's liable, as it should be, that they are still able to transport and get to the grocery store, do those once-a-month trips that sometimes they rely on because they don't have their own vehicle.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Thank you, Senator. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Any objection? Senator Atkinson. Any further objections? Okay. So ordered. And I'll carry that bill.
Could have James call the roll.
Yeah, and with that, we are adjourned.